question. Think. Okay, so one of the complications of sickle cell disease is when the marrow shuts down, you can't produce any more cells. So what's that called? What's hypersplenism? What does that mean? Enlarged spleen. Okay, what's dactylitis?
Fingers,
toes. Okay, so which one is it? Aplastic crisis. Yeah. Okay, which hemoglobin travels with A2 on cellulose acetate? A2. Okay, which one is it? Which one travels the slowest with A2? Do you remember your charts?
D.
Okay, let's go back to the... Don't forget this. I have to go back to where the hemoglobin was. Somewhere. Next. One more. So remember, CEO, so CEO, you can remember that, Chief Executive Officer, okay? Then under Lepore, remember we already talked about Lepore and S, just remember D. We didn't talk about G, okay? So just remember D. All right.
I have a question on those charts. Why is it like some of them like normal cord blood? Is it half of a check or half of a block?
Because normal cord blood you have mostly F, a little bit of A. So it's normal.
Just the relative, how much is there?
Mm-hmm. So remember about 60-40, something like that.
Why is sickle trait and hemoglobin D the same? Just the same.
Okay, hemoglobin D trait. Hemoglobin D migrates with S.
All right.
Okay. So denatured hemoglobin in a cell shows up as what? In a red cell. Heinz buddies. Can you see it on right stain? Okay. All right, we've already talked about hereditary persistence of fetal hemoglobin. Remember, this is when, even after infancy, you still make fetal hemoglobin. And so the switch from the gamma production to the beta production isn't complete. And it's not found very often, about 0.1% African Americans. They really don't have too much problem. But what best way that you can find this is, of course, electrophoresis. If they're heterozygotes, they have about 10 to 30-something fetal hemoglobin. If they're homozygous, they're going to make 100%. So what you might see in a homozygote would be microcytosis. That's why we talked about it when we talked about thalassemias. And they have hypochromia. What you need to know about hemoglobin Kenya is that it's just a variant of hereditary persistence of fetal hemoglobin. So if it's a hemoglobinopathy, You may not see anything but target cells. You might see microhypo if they're homozygous. But when you do the Kleihauer-Betke, which you're doing this week, okay, you're going to see cells that are full of fetal hemoglobin. It's distributed throughout the cell. The reason they show up is they are resistant to acid and alkaline, so they don't lyse. So the background that you see would have been cells if this was a mixed sample of ones that contain A. These are ones that contain F. Okay. So we're on hemolytic disorder. And in order to talk about hemolytic disorder, we have to go back and talk about the membrane of the red cell. Because it's the alteration of the red cell membrane that is when it gets taken out of circulation. That's what causes hemolysis. So if you remember, we have lipids and we have proteins. So we have a membrane that's a bilayer. It has in it phospholipids. It has free cholesterol. And the reason you need the lipids in there is that this is what influences the shape of the cell. So if we have alterations of lipids, we're going to get abnormal shapes. So, for example, stomatocytes. So we're going to talk about some of the abnormalities. But you have the lipid bilayer, and then you have proteins that run clear through the lipid bilayer. Those are called membrane bilayer proteins, and there are two of them. One is called glycophorin, and the glycophorins are called that glyco because they're really rich in carbohydrates. And so they're the main, what we call extrinsic protein, because they usually extend above the red cell. We also have one that's called the band 3, and that's the anion channel. And so we have chloride and bicarbonate that are exchanged through that channel. And this is where hemoglobin will attach at the underneath part of that band 3 to hold hemoglobin in place on the red cell membrane. Then we have some proteins that are called skeletal proteins. So not membrane proteins, but skeletal proteins that then stabilize the shape of our cell. And so we have spectrin. And spectrin has two chains. It has an alpha and a beta chain. And they will intertwine amongst each other. And they form what's called a heterodimer. And then those dimers will interact with each other. And so they can attach head-to-head to form tetramers. Or their tails can attach to band 4.1 and filaments of actin. So this is the main skeletal protein of a red cell. But we also have other bands, and the way they identify these bands is just to do electrophoresis on polyacrylamide gel, and they just name them. So they have a band 4.9, and it stabilizes some actin oligomers. And remember, actin is like a contractile protein. Okay, and there's one called ankyrin. And what ankyrin does is just to bind that beta chain of spectrin to hold it to band 3. So it holds the skeletal membrane to the membrane of the bilayer. So if you look in your book, this was the picture that was in your book. So it shows you AE1, that is the same as band 3. Okay, that's the anion that runs through the lipid bilayer. And then down at the bottom there, you see the alpha and beta chains of spectrin and how they intertwine each other. And then you see the ankyrin that holds the spectrin up to band 3. So it links together the skeletal with the lipid bilayer. There are other pictures that you can see. So this one's a little more detailed, so you can see ankyrin. They've kind of outlined it there in the middle there. That's what binds it to the lipid bilayer. And you can see that there's actin, there's band 4.1, 4.2, adducin. I mean, there are lots of bands in there. But what basically you're looking at here is the skeletal part, which is the spectrin, And then where the spectrin binds together, it forms a tetramer. And so this is a spectrin dimer-dimer interaction. Okay? This is ankyrin that holds this thing together. Okay, here's band, or protein 4.1. But you see that the spectrin is kind of interacting with either 4.1 or with itself. And the reason that's important, I wanted to show you this too. This is the glycophorin. So you see glycophorin is rich in carbohydrates, and they're at the top of the outside of the membrane. That's why it's called an extrinsic protein, as it sticks out there. So in order for a red cell to function normally, it has to have these interactions. So you have a head-to-head interaction of those spectrin dimers. So that's one thing that has to be going. You also have the spectrin tails that are bound to actin by that protein 4.1. And then you have the binding of spectrin to band 3 by ankyrin. And all three of those things have to happen in order for our red cell to be a biconcave disc. So if you have problems with any of these proteins or lipids, you're going to get instability of the membrane. So if you have vertical instability, so if your red cell is not right this way, it's a decreased 4.2 or ankyrin or ankyrin or band 3 or spectrin. Could be any of those things. And if you have an abnormal this way, horizontal, then it could be actin 4.1 adducin, because it promotes that binding of the actin to the spectrin.
So like a spherocyte, that'd be like a vertical problem.
Okay, we'll talk about all of them. Mm-hmm. So these are the things that could be wrong. You could have protein abnormalities. You could have salt and water metabolic abnormalities, because remember the anion channel is where the anions leave. And you could have lipid abnormalities in the membrane. So we're going to go through all these. Okay, so as a red cell ages, it becomes non-deformable. And so its surface area to volume ratio changes, the MCHC changes, and your red cell intrinsic properties are going to change. So in order for them to get through the spleen, they describe the spleen size where they go through the vessels as about maybe 3 to 4 microns. Well, a normal red cell is 7 microns, right? So it has to elongate to go through the spleen cords. If it can't elongate, then there are nice little macrophages just waiting for a cell that can't get through there. And what they do is just take it out. So in order for a cell to get through there, it has to be young. I mean, it can't be more than 120 days old, probably. That's what the age of a red cell is. So when your red cell ages, it loses water and surface area, so it becomes more spherical. Its surface area to volume ratio decreases, and so your MCHC increases. And if you remember, a young red cell has lots of mitochondria to make energy, right? But as a red cell matures, you don't have any mitochondria left. So what is going to be there to generate all the energy? There's nothing left, and so, again, the red cell dies. And actually, there's a little reading that I found that's very dramatic, if I can see it real fast. It describes the death of a red cell. Maybe I'll get to it. When I come to it, I'll just get it. Oh, here it is. The red cell usually goes home to the bone marrow to die. The dying erythrocyte's journey to the bone marrow is at the height of efficiency, for it enables the bone marrow to reuse the iron in the cell and thus forgo having its mineral transported from afar. The grimy task of dismantling the dying erythrocyte falls to a scavenger or phagocyte. A phagocyte is simply a white cell that's turned cannibal. Attracted by the smell of death, the phagocyte hunkers over and devours the erythrocyte. After the phagocyte has digested the erythrocyte, the iron from the erythrocyte is recovered. The iron is then transported by transferrin and soon enters another infant red cell. Thus, the iron literally bridges the gap between life and death. In effect, it receives immortality from the dying erythrocyte. This is the final act in the cycle and the saga of the red cell. It was in a book. I had to copy it. Okay, so what we're looking at is water can go in and out of a red cell freely. It can cross the membrane. It usually follows sodium. So wherever sodium goes, water usually follows. In normality. Okay, so it's the ions, the flow of ions that determines the volume of the red cell. So you remember I said the anion band is band 3. So chloride and bicarb can transverse that band. And you'll remember that potassium levels are high on the inside of a cell, and the sodium levels are lower. So the sodium is usually higher on the outside of a cell, whereas potassium is usually higher on the inside of the cell. So how do they regulate how much sodium and potassium go in and out? They have a little pump that's called the sodium potassium pump. In order to run the sodium potassium pump, it takes energy. And so you have to have ATPs generated in order for that to keep the sodium out, because it can freely come in. If you don't pump out the sodium, then water's going to follow in your cell. It just get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it would pop. So we have to look at how much sodium gets in. Okay, if too much gets in, then water follows and you get swelling. If you have too much potassium out, it's going to decrease the water and you get dehydration of the cell. So our cells live about 120 days. If they don't live that long and we can't keep replacing them, we call it hemolytic anemia. So it means that hemolysis takes place and we can't keep up, therefore we get anemic. And in most hemolytic anemias, those red cells may be living less than 15 to 20 days. Otherwise, we could probably compensate for it. So if your sodium pump fails and you can't get sodium out of your cell, what's going to happen to it?
You can't get sodium out of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's going to swell. So once the cell becomes old, doesn't deform, or if it has any inclusions in it, as it goes through the spleen, which is the major RES system, or in the bone marrow even, it's going to be taken out. So there are different functions that the spleen is going to form. There are mild or subtle abnormalities. Say you have Hal Jolly bodies in your cell. That's a pretty mild problem. As it goes through the spleen, it sees that. And so it'll just pluck out the Hal Jolly body. So that's called pitting. So it's just a subtle change that takes place in the cell, and it reheals itself, and off it goes. If it's more severely injured, it can be removed by the spleen or the entire reticuloendothelial system. Even the liver can do it. If it's really severely injured and is taken out by the RES, it's called extravascular hemolysis. So it's outside of the vessel, but it's in the RES cell. Okay, if it's so severely damaged that it's actually destroyed right in the circulation, it's called intravascular hemolysis. Okay? So here's our spleen. There's a nice picture of our spleen. And so here's a red cell that has to go through the watchful eyes of the spleen. And so it has to squeeze through here. And as it's doing that, there are macrophages that are watching. And if there's anything inside of it, it'll pluck it out. But if it just takes the whole cell out, we call it culling, C-U-L-L-I-N-G. I don't know why it's called that. Pitting and culling is the function of the spleen. But if you're from Idaho, you know what a cull is. Does anybody know what a cull is? You're not from Idaho.
cold cattle, it's just you're killing, your sugar is killing the ones that you're seeing.
Okay, so if you're in Idaho and you're working on the potato farm and you're sitting on the combine and you're watching the potatoes go over, a cull is one that's no good. So you toss it out. So you don't want to buy culled potatoes at the grocery store, and that's what they have. Okay, so one of the places this happens is the spleen. So the more it has to take out, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And so one of the things they do sometimes is to take out the spleen so that your cells can live longer. So that would be a reason for a splenectomy. So you would have a decreased destruction of your red cells. Another reason that they take out spleens is that if you saw some of those people that had the huge spleens, there's so much pressure in the abdominal cavity, they take it out to relieve pressure. And then another reason is if their platelets are trapped in there, they would take out the spleen.
If they take out the spleen, when the red blood cells die on a normal basis, can they still recycle that iron?
They can, because you still have the RES system in the liver.
And that one will work as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if your spleen gets bigger, will it just increase its function? So
it sequesters the cells. It does. It tries to, but it sequesters the cells, so you get more and more of them being destroyed.
So, well, what I'm asking is it just kind of hell with problem alone?
Yeah.
And then if the problem would be resolved, would this spleen shrink back to normal size?
Okay, now you're saying after it's been big?
Yeah. So once it's gotten huge, it'll stay that huge.
Yeah. Okay, so if you notice up in our little boxes, we have a whole section that's called splenectomy. So if somebody's had a splenectomy, what do you see on their smear if they don't have a spleen? Well, you're going to see these kinds of things because that's what the spleen does. So you'll see lots of Hal Jolly Buddies because nobody's there to take those out. They don't pit. You'll see codocytes. You'll see echinocytes. Your MCV is going to be increased. You'll see retics.
I have splenectomy.
Did you? Have you got Hal Jolly's? Get his blood. So what we're going to talk about then are the hemolytic anemias. So we're going to classify them two ways. Congenital versus acquired. So are you born with this problem or do you get it? But also intrinsic versus extrinsic. So with intrinsic, it means that you have a defect in the stem cells. With extrinsic, it means the red cells are damaged by some outside force. So intrinsic means there's a enzyme abnormality, there's a spectrin. I mean, it's inherited usually. So we're going to look at some of these. So there's a whole list of inherited disorders that we'll talk about. So it could be the membrane, it could be the enzymes, it could be the globin structure. And then there's a whole bunch of external things we'll talk about. So let's go through some of them. First of all, you have to decide, where is this red cell being broken up? Where is it dying and being carried away? So if it's not too bad of a change in the cell, it will be taken out in the reticuloendothelial system. And so it will be degraded in the RES. And so that's called extravascular hemolysis. So it's outside of the vessel. If it's so damaged that it's going to be destroyed right in the circulation, it's called intravascular. So one of the things you have to do in the lab is decide where is the red cell being taken out? Where is it breaking down? So in extravascular, it's in the RES. And what do we look for? We look for an increase in bilirubin, which is a breakdown product of heme. We look for increase in urine urobilinogen. And we look for an increase in lactic dehydrogenase. So all of those are being increased because it's taken out in the RES. So this is extravascular hemolysis, and you have to remember this. The oldies have had it once, so it's not fair. So here's hemoglobin. Okay, you're breaking it down, but it's happening in the RES. You release bilirubin. Bilirubin has to be carried to the liver to be conjugated. So it goes into the liver, gets conjugated, it comes out as water-soluble bilirubin, and it goes out through the GI tract, is absorbed and excreted either in the stool or it gets recycled and is excreted in the urine as urobilinogen. So extravascular, what you're looking for is a damaged cell that goes into the RE system. Okay, bilirubin is made from the heme. The iron's released. So iron's picked up by transferrin, gets back to the bone marrow. But the bilirubin then goes into the liver cell, gets conjugated, comes out, is made into urobilinogen, gets excreted. Okay, if the cell is so damaged that it actually gets broken down in the vessel, it's going to release free hemoglobin. So anything that's released in the blood has to have a carrier protein. And so the carrier protein that picks up free hemoglobin is haptoglobin. And so if you see your haptoglobin going down, it means it's binding to hemoglobin. So that's how you measure it. And then you'll see the breakdown products of, again, hemoglobin. So in the urine, you're going to see hemosiderin. So hemosiderin is what? Just storage iron of, or storage of iron in a cell. So your kidney cells will actually pick up some of this iron. You're also going to see free hemoglobin in the urine. So hemoglobin is kind of a red color, so the urine's kind of red. So in intravascular hemolysis, it's so bad that it pops right in the circulation. So the hemoglobin picks up with a carrier called haptoglobin. It goes to the liver. It gets catabolized. But there's not very much haptoglobin. So there's still going to be some free hemoglobin. It goes to the kidney through the circulation. You're going to see hemoglobin in the urine, okay? And you'll see hemosiderin. So it picks up that iron and puts it in the kidney cells. So when you're looking at this, intravascular is when you pop this cell and release the hemoglobin directly into the bloodstream. Then it just picks up. Some of it goes to the kidney. Some of it gets picked up with haptoglobin. So what we look for is a decrease in haptoglobin. So remember this. This tells you what happens. So what's the difference then? If we get increased in bilirubin because we're breaking down hemoglobin, that happens. We get increased urobilinogen, we get increased LD. So the thing that's quite different is this right here. So if we see a decrease in haptoglobin, it means that we've got intravascular. And then if we see free hemoglobin in the urine, it also means we have intravascular.
So in extravascular, there still is an increase in...
Okay. So if a red cell is so severely damaged, where does it get hemolyzed? So yell it out. What is it? Intravascular. Okay. Okay, what's the one laboratory test that's decreased in intravascular hemolysis and not in extravascular? So yell it out. Haptoglobin. Okay, so let's look at some of the defects that we see in the membrane. Okay, one of the real common ones is hereditary spherocytosis. We call it HS. It's inherited as an autosomal dominant, but it can be recessive. The patients have anemia. They have jaundice because they're breaking it down. They have splenomegaly. The symptoms vary. It's not uncommon for them to have gallstones. And remember, they have gallstones because gallstones are made out of bilirubin. And so they have gallstones many times. That's their history. Oops. So what's the problem with these people? Well, there can be lots of problems. It could be ankyrin, could be protein 3, could be 4.1, could be 4.2. But the most common defect is they've got a spectrin to 4.1 interaction defect. So it doesn't work at the 4.1 for some reason. So their little cells have to work lots harder. And so their sodium pump has to work harder because they have this passive influx of sodium. And so their cells take a lot more energy. So they have to go through the Emden-Meyerhoff pathway more often to get ATPs to make their pump run. So it's this membrane defect that they can't keep up. So you'll see spherocytes being formed. And you remember that spherocytes are not a biconcave disc. So now they are round, they're sphere. And they don't go through the spleen very well because they can't deform. And so the spleen takes them out. And you get a hemolytic anemia. So what you're going to see in the laboratory would be an increased MCHC. Usually the MC is pretty close to normal. Okay, these people try to keep up, so they're going to retic. And so you should see about a 5 to 20% retic count. So that's why you'd see the diffusely basophilic erythrocytes.
So if your sodium pump isn't working, then you have more sodium in the cell.
Okay, they lose membrane is why they don't swell and pop. They can't keep up, but they do lyse easier, which I'll show you in just a minute. Okay, so if you look at the cells that haven't been taken out, they're going to appear as a sphere and their MCHC is increased. So what you look at on the blood smear is you'll see spherocytes, but you'll also see that they're reticking because they've got polychromatophilia and huge red cells. So they're trying to keep up. So the test that you do to diagnose HS is to do the osmotic fragility. So you've already done that. And if you have a patient that has HS, you get an increased osmotic fragility. If you just took their cells and you just let them sit in an incubator overnight, they'll actually hemolyze. So if you put your blood there, there probably isn't going to be any hemolysis. But in an HS person, they're going to hemolyze because they run out of energy. There's no glucose there. They don't have a person eating glucose for them, so they have glucose to go through the Emden-Meyerhoff to make ATPs. So if they don't have any energy, then water comes in as sodium can't leave, and they hemolyze. So the autohemolysis means you just draw their blood, they hemolyze themselves if there's no glucose. Now, if you gave those cells glucose, they'd be able to keep up for a little longer. So in the chemistries, we see the bilirubin increased, the fecal and urine urobilinogen increased, the LD increased, the haptoglobin may be decreased if they're taken out intracellular, or intravascular, sorry. So their bone marrow is geared up, so they have erythroid hyperplasia. So on top here is the osmotic fragility with HS. So as you did that, here's a normal control down here. So remember, you add different volumes of salt, and you see how well they can stand the change in the salt concentration. So here's a normal. They start to lyse at about 8. Eight or nine. But in a person that has hereditary spherocytosis, they start to lyse much earlier. Okay? So they do lyse. You don't see it on a smear, but if you run the test, you'll see that they have an increased osmotic fragility. So in your hemolysis chart, you remember that this is normal, and this is spherocytosis. Okay, so they just can't keep up. This is autohemolysis. So you just incubate these cells, put them in a water bath, don't add any glucose, and what you see in a patient that has HS is hemolysis. In a patient that doesn't, there's no hemolysis. So if you were to add glucose, it's going to help because it gives them ATPs. So in summary then, HS is a deficiency in the surface area, causes the red cells to become spherical. More sodium goes into the cell, so you need more action of the sodium-potassium pump. So they use more glucose. The instability then, if you don't have enough glucose, leads to a reduction of the surface area. So you get the spare, you get the increase in MCHC. And this is the most common hereditary hemolytic anemia. So it is not uncommon to see HS. So what you do is on the smear, you see the spherocytes and the retics, the polychromasia. Okay, the MCHC is probably increased. You do an osmotic fragility, it's going to be increased. Okay, that's HS. Now, you're going to have to learn what a DAT is, so I put the definition right here, so when we talk about it in a minute. The DAT is a direct antiglobulin test. And what it's looking for is antigen-antibody interaction. So these people don't have antibodies hanging on their red cell. The red cell is not lysing because of antibodies. So when you see a negative DAT, it tells you it's not antibody-induced. Okay, so just kind of keep that in the back of your head for a little while. So if a person has HS and they have real severe anemia, they take out their spleen. Okay. Let's talk about HE, hereditary elliptocytosis or ovalocytosis, if you want to call it ovalocytosis. Most of these people don't have a problem. Some do. If they do, it's usually mild, and their bone marrow can usually keep up, and they don't get anemic. Some have a real problem. So there are different types of HE. The common HE ranges from nothing to severe hemolysis. And then, depending on how they look, they've classified this into how the ovalocyte looks, or the elliptocyte. If it's kind of a spherical, they call it sphericytic hereditary elliptocytosis. And those people have more hemolysis because of the shape. There's some that look like stomatocytes, but they're still ovalocytes. And then there is one that where you get a double dose. They think rather than one gene being abnormal, you get two abnormal genes, and they call it hereditary pyropoikilocytosis, or HPP. Okay, if you have double dose, it usually shows up in real early infancy, and you get a lot of hemolysis. So here's a kid who has hereditary elliptocytosis. This is a one that probably has HPP, homozygous, so it's a manifest real early in childhood. Look at the size of the spleen. So you can see why they have to do splenectomy. They don't like to do it before 2 or 3 years of age, or else they die of pneumococcal infections. So they have to wait till their immune system's a little bit ready to do that, but they take out the spleen. Okay, so the most common one we see is the one that's inherited as an autosomal dominant. They just have one gene abnormal. So that's HE. So the problem here is a defect in the skeletal proteins. So it's a horizontal problem. So it's either a decrease in the spectrum dimers to form the tetramer, or you might have a deficiency in band 4.1. Or you might have an abnormal glycophorin C or a band 3. There are just several things that could happen to cause this problem. But it's a horizontal problem. So you get parts of the membrane that fragment off. The cell seals up, and it reduces the deformability of the cell, so they don't live as long. So they think that you might also have abnormal permeability to sodium, and so the pump's going to have to run and you have to have a little bit more energy. If you get a double dose, then you either have a mutant alpha or beta spectrum, and it can associate with each other. So this is the difference. If on the smear you see the most common form, you're just going to see about 15% elliptocytes. If you get a sphericytic HE, then you get a morphology of an elliptocyte that looks like a spherocyte, or a stomatocyte, or the most uncommon would be HPP. You get poik, you get microcytes, you get budding off of cells, and it looks like a patient that's a burn patient. So I'll show you what that looks like. So this is the most common kind. You just see elliptocytes. So most of them don't have a problem. Some do. This is HPP. So if you look, you get a lot of poik. But see all the fragments, the little tiny microspherocytes, the fragments? So this is a lot more severe. So it's just supposedly a double dose of an abnormal gene. So it's the spectrin abnormalities.
The cells, like at 1 o'clock, I can talk right there. Are those
we call budding cells? Uh-huh. They just pull off, bud off. Kind of like yeast. Okay, so doesn't that look like a yeast cell that has a bud? Okay, so this is what you do on them. It depends on what you see out here, but the most common you're going to see is HE, and they're just plain old valvocytes. Okay, if you get microcytes and budding, it's HPP. Your retics slightly increased, but you can differentiate this from spherocytosis because you do an osmotic fragility and it's normal.
So is tomatocytic or spherocytic more common between those two?
I have no idea. But the most common is the just plain old valvocytes. Okay, so if they're asymptomatic, don't treat them. If they are symptomatic, they take out their spleen. Okay, you can have hereditary stomatocytosis. And the stomatocytes are also called hydrocytes. Clinically, they may have a spleen that's slightly enlarged. And they think that the pathology behind this is there's an influx of sodium which exceeds the loss of potassium. So as sodium comes in, you pump potassium to keep the balance, or you pump potassium out and it's 2-to-1. So the enzyme that runs the pump gets overwhelmed. It can't keep up. And so what happens is you got too much sodium inside, so water comes in, and what happens is that you get a ratio of the surface area to volume that's decreased. And so they think it's probably a defect in, again, a membrane protein called stomatin, and that's why they called it stomatocyte. But most cells are real active, and so the problem in these patients that they've seen is they have a tendency to clot and form thrombus. So the only thing you're going to see in the lab maybe is a mild anemia to a moderate, but you see stomatocytes. And this, they're going to retic depending on how much they take out. You're going to see increased bilirubin. And since the surface-to-volume ratio is different, you can fill up this cell a little more with water. So you're going to see a pinpoint. But the osmotic fragility is increased, and the autohemolysis is increased. So it's sort of like spherocytosis. But you can tell the difference by looking at the smear. So this is hereditary stomatocytosis. And really the only thing that you're going to see different is the MCHC, because it's a bigger cell than the hereditary spherocytosis, because they're just smaller cells. So the MCHC is decreased. And if you see stomatocytes in that number, it's probably hereditary stomatocytosis, because there's nothing else that will form those.
So would you say it's like 4+?
If you see more than 1 or 2 per field, it's probably, it depends on how many are taken out by the spleen.
But it's stomatocytes that also are seen in the
liver disease, because of the alteration of the membrane proteins and lipids.
But it wouldn't be as severe as spherocytosis.
You should have a patient history, okay? If it's hereditary, it's been occurring throughout their lifetime. If it's acquired, it's probably alcoholism. So treatment, not usually necessary. If they do have a problem, they take out their spleen. But you do have to kind of have a history to see if it's liver disease. Okay, I love this one. How do you say it? I say it, xerocytosis. Okay, this is caused by an influx of potassium. So this has a leaky membrane, but you don't have spherocytes and you don't have stomatocytes. So you call it xero. No, xerocytosis. Only spell it the right way. But they go dehydrated because of the potassium. So what happens on the smear is that it looks like the hemoglobin's been targeted or contracted in the cell. So their MCV increases and their MCHC increases, but their osmotic fragility decreases. So this would be a xerocytosis. So what you're looking for, and this best we could find, are these kinds of things where they're kind of puddled, or this looks like an overlap. See right here? Where it's kind of puddled and it looks like a targeted area, or it's got too many other things going on to just be a plain old target cell. So look for puddled hemoglobin. Okay.
Yeah. Question on that. So if we saw that on like a slide, would we say like Z-quake plus puddled hemoglobin?
Uh-huh. Yeah, the puddled hemoglobin is what you're looking for. And you can differentiate this from thalassemias. I mean, I'd be thinking thal major if I saw that much poik. Well, thal major is not going to have an MCV that's increased, is it? It's decreased. Okay. MCHC, the only thing that increases MCHC are these abnormal cells that have abnormal shapes. Okay, don't, because what you look at is the surface to volume ratio. So it has more surface area. That's why it puddles. That's why you get the target. So it's a larger cell. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we do have hereditary problems in the bilayer. So if you have an increase in membrane lecithin, that's a phospholipid, then you're going to have a problem. So these red cells get stressed. If you have lecithin cholesterol ACL transferase deficiency, that's the thing that transports cholesterol. So it's going to give you an increase in cholesterol in the membrane. And all we're doing here is saying, if you have problems in the lipids of the membrane, it's going to cause a problem. Okay, so they can get hemolytic anemia. We're not going to go into any big detail about them, except on this one, because it's my favorite. And that is hereditary acanthocytosis, which means they have A-beta lipoproteinemia. They can't make the beta lipoproteins. And so they have a recessive disease where they can't absorb fat because they don't have the carrier protein for that lipid. And so these people have major problems. They have neurologic damage. They have eye problems. They have mental retardation. So it's a big problem. So it's a deficiency in the apolipoprotein B, and we see it manifest then in the cell because of the lipid content. So our red cells have increased sphingomyelin over lecithin, and that causes the cells to be acanthocytes. So if you see a normocytic, normochromic anemia, the indices are normal, the retics probably normal to slightly increased, but you see this smear, okay, and we say, what could this be? A beta lipoproteinemia or hereditary acanthocytosis. So remember, acanthocytes have no central pallor and they have irregular shapes. Okay, but the no central pallor is the biggie, right? Okay, so tomorrow we will finish. So remember acanthocytes and keep saying that. A beta lipoproteinemia. And not one BYU student has ever missed that on the national exam.